Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1912, the first International Eugenics Congress met in London. And 2 years later, in 1914, the Congress's vice president went on to organize the first National Conference on Race Betterment in Michigan. And that man, who championed the forced sterilization of so-called feeble-minded Americans and called for, quote, the suppression of moral defectives, his name was Charles William Eliot. He also happened to be president emeritus of Harvard University. And as writer Adam Cohen notes, Eliot and Harvard lent considerable legitimacy and clout to the global eugenics movement in the 20th century. And in fact, the university was seen as the brain trust of 20th century eugenics. Cohen also writes that the role Harvard played is little remembered or remarked upon today. But he pulls back the curtain on that history in his new book, Imbeciles, the Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. He'll be talking about it tonight at Harvard Bookstore at 7 p.m., but he's with us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
Okay, so there's so much history to dig in here. Can we just first start with Charles Eliot, President Emeritus at Harvard? Tell us a little bit more about his role in 20th century eugenics.
Sure. And I say this as someone who was at Harvard for 7 years and spent a lot of time in Eliot House, and I didn't know anything about President Eliot's eugenic past. But yes, he spoke to the Harvard Club of San Francisco in 1914 and talked about an issue that was very dear to his heart, racial purity. He was vice president of that International Eugenics Congress. And he also advocated eugenic sterilization of the feeble-minded and other unfit. This wasn't that unusual for upper-class, progressive, well-educated people at that time. Eugenics was very popular, but the role that Harvard played through Eliot, through another president, Lowell, through some of the genetics faculty, was really extraordinary. You're right to say that they were in many ways a brain trust.
And it wasn't particularly limited to just on-campus activities or advocacy. They did actually take their eugenics advocacy off campus and into the highest reaches of the U.S. government, right?
That's correct. They spoke about it at conferences, and the eugenics faculty, one professor, Edward East, wrote a book, Inbreeding and Outbreeding, their genetic and sociological significance, about race mixing. They were writing a lot of the texts that people around the country were reading that taught them that eugenics was good science. So as with almost everything Harvard does, it has an influence, you know, well beyond Cambridge. And that was true of Harvard's role in eugenics.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about some of the major figures in the Harvard 20th century eugenics movement, if I can call it that. I mean, Oliver Wendell Holmes Senior, father of the man who went on to become Chief Justice of the United States, and you write about in detail in your new book. I mean, his father was dean of the Harvard Medical School, the man who invented the word Boston Brahmins. How do they play into Harvard's embrace of eugenics?
Yes, it's very interesting. It's true that Dr. Holmes Sr. Was the inventor of the coiner of the term Boston Brahmin, and it really captured the way the Boston upper class old families felt about themselves. They were looking to India and the idea of the caste system, and they felt that just like the Brahmins were at the top of that system, and in fact endowed by God in caste theory, they felt that they had a very special role in society. So that was something Dr. Holmes believed, and he inculcated it also in his son, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. So from an early age, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. was taught to be very proud of his parentage, proud of his ancestors, and to feel better, really, than, you know, most of the people around him. And that became very important when he became a justice.
Well, in fact, you quote an article that Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. wrote in 1875 in The Atlantic, where he talks about his admiration for Francis Galton, one of the English sort of champions of eugenics. And Holmes wrote that, quote, if genius and talent are inherited, as Mr. Galton has so conclusively shown, why should not deep-rooted moral defects show themselves in the descendants of moral monsters?
Absolutely. And this is so early for American eugenics. Dr. Holmes, who, in addition to other things, was the dean of Harvard Medical School, he was a very early believer and supporter of eugenics.
Okay. And so this is so interesting because we have all these different areas under the umbrella of Harvard coming together. Holmes with medicine and science as it was practiced at the time. Eliot, as we talked about a little earlier. And then you mentioned another Harvard president, Lawrence Lowell, who was a very active supporter of eugenics to the point where he allowed a particular group access to Harvard files to see whether or not eugenics theories could play in figuring out who a good Harvard student was. Do I have that right?
Yeah, they wanted to do research on Harvard fathers and sons to see what the genetic lay of the land was there. And President Eliot agreed, and I'm sorry, President Lowell agreed. And President Lowell's secretary, who responded to the letter, said, you know, this is a personal, you know, very strong interest of his.
Well, and there's an interesting quotation you have from Lowell. He said, "The need for homogeneity in a democracy is important, and resisting the influx of great numbers of a greatly different race." And this gets us right down to one of the major drivers of American eugenics as it played out amongst these leading lights at Harvard: immigration.
Absolutely. There were Harvard alumni who organized an anti-immigration league very early to work to close America's doors to foreigners. And it had an expressly eugenic purpose at the time. They almost called themselves the Eugenic League because they were concerned not just about foreigners showing up, but about foreigners who they thought had bad genes, who were unfit, who were going to degrade the American gene pool. That's what they were afraid of. And it took them decades, but they were a driving force behind what eventually became the Immigration Act of 1924, which drastically cut immigration from non-Northern European countries. And this was what they wanted for eugenic reasons.
So tell me a little bit more about that, because, you know, it's one thing for one of the world's most famous universities to, whether directly or indirectly, sanction eugenics. It's another thing for actual policy to be made by virtue of the efforts of those advocates. I mean, how much more influence did they have in terms of immigration? And you talk about intelligence testing as well.
Absolutely. And they were very influential in getting eventually a literacy test applied for immigrants, which was something they spent decades doing, but eventually succeeded in doing. This was something that was a lot of the alumni doing it. They were working with alumni around the country, sometimes with Harvard clubs in other parts of the country. So there were the alumni, there was the administration, the Lowells and the Eliots, and then there was the faculty. And all of these parts of Harvard were being influential, as Harvard is good at doing.
Hmm. Well, we're speaking with Adam Cohen. He's author of Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. He'll be reading from the book and talking about it tonight at the Harvard Bookstore. There's information about that at our website, radioboston.org. But we're talking to him now. And Adam, I'm curious. We've sort of been talking about the intellectual leaders of Harvard in the early 20th century and their embrace of eugenics. But of course, you know, the backdrop, the historical backdrop to this that comes later is Nazi Germany and the practice of eugenics there. I mean, was Harvard at all influential in the formation of Nazi extermination policies?
I wouldn't say that, but they were influential in getting the American eugenics movement started, and the American eugenics movement did provide, in many ways, the blueprint for the Nazis. The Nazis expressly modeled their eugenics programs on American statutes, which were drawn up at the state level, and there was a eugenics record office on Long Island that was very influential in that. But Harvard, you know, played its role. As I mentioned, President Emeritus Eliot expressly endorsed eugenic sterilization at a time very early when people were wondering if this was a good idea or a crazy idea. So Harvard's influence and prestige certainly supported it. But, you know, one other, I really do want to mention Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. because he played such an important role. And he was so steeped in Harvard. His earliest ancestor graduated from Harvard in the 1600s. He went to Harvard. He went to Harvard Law School. He was a Harvard law professor. And he was the one who wrote this case that I
speak Carrie about. Buck case.
The Carrie Buck case. And, you know, this was a case where Carrie Buck was asking not to be eugenically sterilized, right? She's a young woman who had been designated feeble-minded, although she wasn't. She was asserting a constitutional right not to have the state of Virginia cut
into. Can I interject here for a second? Because even how she was designated feeble-minded is quite astonishing to think about today. I mean, like, why was she given that horrible label to begin with?
Oh, her story is just so terribly sad. She was a poor girl who was taken in by a foster family, raped by a nephew, and then when she became pregnant out of wedlock, the family wanted to get rid of her. So they decided to say that she was epileptic, which she was not, and feeble-minded, and they got her sent to the colony for epileptic and feeble-minded. It's just a terrible story. And then they took the baby that that she gave birth to and kept it as kept her as their own. So her story is horrible. But when all this gets up to the Supreme Court, you might think Oliver Wendell Holmes, this is such a respected jurist, a man who's so wise and fair. Isn't this exactly who Carrie Buck should entrust with her fate, with, you know, her ability to, you know, not be sterilized, not to have the state of Virginia cut into her? But sure enough, Oliver Wendell Holmes, taught by his father, believed in eugenics, believed that people like him and his father and their families were better than people like Carrie Buck. And he actually supported eugenics long before this case. And he very happily said she should be sterilized. And he had this famous line in the decision, three generations of imbeciles are enough, about Carrie, her mother, and the baby. And that was such an elitist worldview that expressed itself, but in a very powerful way that changed the law in the United States and became, you know, it established the rule that eugenic sterilization was constitutional.
I mean, it's an amazing decision, right? Because he writes about the fact that he believed that Americans needed to sterilize people who, quote, sap the strength of the state.
Precisely. And what's so galling about that, in addition to just that wording, which you quote, which is horrible, is, you know, the case before the court was, should Carrie Buck be sterilized? And the court not only said, yes, she should, it actually urged the nation to do more sterilization. It said, we need more of this. We need to sterilize all those people out there who might sap the strength of the state. So that's a very strange role for the Supreme Court to play. To not only say, this is constitutional, but to say, go do more eugenics.
And in fact, over the course of many decades, what, tens of thousands of Americans were forcibly sterilized?
As many as 70,000 were forcibly sterilized, and many more were kept in these colonies until their reproductive years were over. So they were really imprisoned for eugenic reasons, imprisoned because the state was afraid that they would have, you know, unfit children. So there was so much suffering. And then, as I say, it became the model for the Nazis. And in fact, at the Nuremberg trials, and this is in the movie Judgment at Nuremberg, when we prosecuted the Nazis for the eugenic sterilization program, they cited Buck v. Bell. They quoted it and they said, you know, how can you say that we're so bad? This is your own Supreme Court. This is your own Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Now, you know, to be fair, Harvard obviously wasn't the only institution in the United States that had champions of eugenics on its campus. It's arguably the most famous, but, you know, similar stories in the early 20th century were coming out of Yale, for example, and others. But nevertheless, as you write about the story in detail in your book, and also there's a article you have in the Harvard Magazine, reckoning with history is something that a lot of institutions, and especially institutions of higher ed, are going through right now in profound ways. So why do you think is important, or why do you think it's important for Harvard to reckon with this part of its history?
Exactly. And Harvard Law School, as we know, just changed its shield, and Harvard College just agreed to change the use of the word master. So we're in a time of looking back and reevaluating. And I think we need to reevaluate the eugenics era for a few reasons. One is that it just was a terrible wrong that was done, both with the sterilizations and with the immigration law that kept so many people out of the country for eugenic reasons, including Jews who were trying to flee Nazi Germany. So there's a terrible people passed there. But also, eugenics is going to have even more of a moment coming in the days ahead, because the science is moving so quickly, the genetic science. We now have the ability to edit the human embryo and create what people are calling designer babies. Our ability to shape humanity has never been what it is now. And these changes, when we edit the embryo, will actually be inherited by future generations. So the power to make eugenic decisions is going to be greater in the next few years than it ever was before. Harvard is in the middle of a lot of this. And I'm not saying that it's bad. I believe a lot of this science can actually do good. But we really need to look at the past and make sure that we're not repeating some of the same mistakes.
Hmm. And just as a fact check there, a Harvard panel, by the way, at the Harvard Law School has recommended that the seal be changed. They haven't made it official yet. But my last question to you, Adam, is this is such a fascinating history, and it does reveal so much about the influence of institutions like Harvard and the relationship between, you know, science, immigration, policy, history, and the aims and goals of certain powerful elite in this country. But I'm wondering what really drew you to it to begin with, because I haven't seen such an exhaustive uncovering of American eugenics, specifically in the Harvard context, before.
Yeah, well, when I was at Harvard Law School, I learned a lot about many Supreme Court cases, many of them terrible. This was really the one we didn't learn about, you know, and it was amazing. It wasn't in the con law class I took, in the 1,700-page con law treatise that, you know, everyone uses. It's a half of a sentence and a footnote. So yet we knew this phrase. We would say it among ourselves, the law students: three generations of imbeciles are enough. And we knew that Oliver Wendell Holmes said that. So when I thought about, you know, writing about the Supreme Court, I thought, this is really something that was important, and it was terrible, and no one's talking about it. And, you know, why not dig around here and really see what went on and share it with people? And I'm amazed by how many very well-educated people I see all the time. When I talk to them about this, they say, wow, why did no one tell me that the Supreme Court did this? Why did no one tell me that this went on? And that was sort of the motivating force behind writing the book.
One wonders if now there's a form of reckoning that could happen at Harvard Law School with at least studying the case in more detail.
Oh, I thought you were going to say rename Elliott and Lowell House. I'm not calling for that, though.
We'll start with studying the case as it exists. Well, Adam Cohen is author of Imbeciles, the Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Kerry Buck. He will be reading from his book and talking about it tonight at 7 o'clock at Harvard Bookstore. There's more information about that at our website, radioboston.org. Adam Cohen, really fascinating to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure.